This is an ABC podcast.
Voters in the bush plead for better health services ahead of tomorrow's election. They say they're tired of making do with less than metro constituents.
It's, you know, such a mindset, especially in the bush, should we write? But, you know, that support is so needed out here and it's so hard to get, and so you fall back all the time on that. Should we write, mate?
And Mad Max rolls into the small regional town of Hay in New South Wales.
I think there's a 100% occupancy rate at the moment. If you drive down the main street, you'll see their neon no vacancy signs in the window, so you know that things are good when you see those.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Only a few days ago, the Australian Electoral Commission warned voters in dozens of regional towns across South Australia, Queensland and Western Australia that they may not have a polling centre in their town on election day because of worker shortages. But a last-minute call-out has seen the Electoral Commission recruit an extra 7,000 workers in the bush. There have also been last-minute changes to the rules for people who test positive with COVID, which means anyone who tested positive since 6pm last Friday can call up and complete their vote. Evan Eakin-Smythe is the Director of Media and Digital Engagement for the Australian Electoral Commission, and he joins me now. Now, Evan Eakin-Smythe, the staffing concerns have been eased from a few days ago, but there's still 15 polling venues of concern. Are you confident that voters will be able to use them tomorrow?
Look, we're hopeful. I can't give you anything more than that. What we've got is a pandemic federal election that is incredibly difficult. And to put that into context, we've got about 105,000 staff around the nation that we need. In just the last week alone, we've had about 15% of that entire figure drop out, and we've been replacing them. So it's a really fluid situation. That's tens of thousands of people that we've had to replace in a single week. So we've been able to do some really good work, particularly in regional areas, to reach out to a range of databases and get the help of colleagues from across public services and a range of other bodies like the emergency services and education departments and the like, to get people to put their hand up in local areas. We cannot open a polling place without local people working at them, and we're trying as hard as possible to open every single one.
So tell me where those shortfalls are, those 15 booths.
We've gotten it down to two in Queensland at the moment, but as I said, it's a roving thing. So Currumbin, and you'll have to excuse me, I don't live in all these locations, Cowanamma. There's areas in South Australia as well. It's a list of five, Coonawarra, Arno Bay, Georgetown, Wirral. And in Western Australia, we've got a little bit of a longer list, Broomhill, Coolgardie, Hopetown, Newgate, and a couple of others. I'm sorry, I don't have the full list in front of me. Those are areas of concern right now, or as of this morning. Hopefully, those areas, we have managed to recruit people through the day. But as I said, with COVID furloughing, it's a very tricky task.
So, Evan, for people who are listening who may live in those areas, which will be the case for Australia-wide, what do they do? How do they know, one, that their polling venue is open, or two, does it mean they have a long drive ahead of them?
It potentially means some people have a long drive ahead of them, hopefully. And in some of these areas, we do have early voting centres. So if you're listening and an early voting centre is open until 6pm on Friday, come on down, would be our encouragement. A lot of people in regional areas have been postal voters, sometimes general postal voters, year after election after election. So we're hoping that people have accessed other services, but some people may need to have a bit of a drive.
Do you know the percentage of regional postal voters at the moment?
I know the total number of postal voters this election, which was 2.7 million, which is easily over a million more than we had in 2019. So there have been more people applying for a postal vote, significantly more, including in regional areas, than in the past.
So it's a really shifting ground this time round, because, you know, the 2019 election, there was more people voting earlier than there ever had been before. And obviously these figures are climbing, and then you throw COVID into the mix, and you've got this whole confluence of events happening for the Electoral Commission. Do you think this is going to permanently change how people vote when we look at other elections?
Potentially. Our evidence, and it's more anecdotal than not, but the numbers suggest it. Whenever somebody casts a pre-poll vote, and they've gone up from election to election, but a significant rise this time around, whenever they do it, they typically don't go back. And people obviously look at their voting options as well. A pandemic is unusual. We've been working incredibly hard to open as many centres as possible, provide telephone voting for people who are COVID positive, couriered mail services for people overseas where we haven't been able to open voting centres because of local COVID conditions. It's a different election. Not only that, we have floods in certain regions in Australia that we've had to work around and pivot and do different polling places. It's difficult. And if we look at some of our international colleagues, I mean, I look at Canada, who ran a federal election late in 2021. They didn't have any voting options for COVID. They had some closures. So these sorts of things aren't unexpected. But when you get to an individual voter level, well, of course, you just want your voting centre like you always have. Mm. But it's not quite that easy sometimes.
Now, one of the things you've had to pivot around, of course, is COVID. Can you talk listeners through, if you have had COVID, how that's working? So if you've tested positive to COVID, how do you vote using the phone?
Yes. So obviously, 7-day isolation requirements in place across the nation at the moment. So it really affects people who tested positive to COVID from the Saturday through to, obviously, past election day. For those people, telephone voting solution in place. And our real strong encouragement is if you've got access to the internet, that's how you register. You go to aec.gov.au and you sign up there. It's a 2-minute odd registration process, and then you get texted or emailed or provided all the registration details to make the call.
But can you, like, if I was to make the call tomorrow to vote, what do I do? I'm a bit kind of bamboozled as to how that would work. Is someone talking to me, or what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we have 5,000 operators in call centres all around the country. So it's real people, not a machine. The registration process is online, but then you call up a real person, and we want you to come informed. So we want you to know how you're going to number your ballot papers when you ring up to vote. Because essentially you're telling that operator how to number your ballot paper. They number one for you, and it's in the presence of scrutineers and AEC supervision. And then they pop it in the ballot box for you.
Wow, that's something to have to pull off at last minute, I can imagine. 5,000 people in a call centre. So going back to those 15 polling venues that are of concern that may not be manned, could it be an option for those people to, I know it was hard fought to get this televoting up, but could it be an option for them to be able to access that? Is that on the cards at all?
It's not, unfortunately. Ultimately, electoral laws were brought in place to cover COVID-19 pandemic circumstances. It was for COVID-positive people. So legally, we cannot have anybody sign up to the telephone voting service unless they have tested positive.
Fair enough. And with the, just going back to the 76 polling booths that were of concern, and now you've managed to do this massive recruitment drive, how well staffed are they going to be? Like, how many people have you managed to pull in, or should people go to the polling booth tomorrow expecting that it might be stretched, the regional booths?
I think expect that it might be stretched. Some of them will be really well staffed because we have had a lot of local people put up their hands, but some won't be. But to give you a further idea, I talked about a turnover of staff of about 10 or 15,000 in a week. We're also going to very inventive ways. We've actually got our chief financial officer working as the officer in charge in a polling place in rural Western Australia. Those are the sort of lengths that we're going to. We're pulling out every single stop to make sure we can open as many doors as we can and with as many people there as we can.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
They're certainly pulling out all stops. Evan Eakin-Smythe from the Australian Electoral Commission. Living in regional and remote parts of Australia comes with its challenges. A big one is the distance that you need to travel to access health facilities that are everywhere in the city. It's not unusual to have to travel hours to get an x-ray, see a doctor or give birth. And telehealth is just part of daily living. But how committed are the major parties to improving access to these services? Madeline McCusker took a look and filed this story.
Casey Owen has been running her own cafe in the small outback town of Longreach for the past 3 years.
Hey, how you going? What can we get for you today?
She's seen scores of young people make the Western Queensland town their home and reckons access to mental health services is top of the mind for many young voters heading to the polls this weekend.
It's, such a mindset, especially in the bush, should we write? But that support is so needed out here and it is so hard to get, and so you fall back all the time on that, she'll be right, mate. Sometimes it's not, and that's okay, but to have that support around you is really, really important.
Like many remote towns, living in a hub like Longreach means having to travel hours for appointments. Casey Owen says that's simply not good enough.
Getting an appointment here is a long wait, and so a lot of people do find it is easier to travel outside.
It's a similar story right across regional Australia.
Yeah, well, sadly, we know that for those that live outside major cities in Australia, they're much more likely to die from their chronic diseases. We have a much higher rate of death from things like diabetes and heart disease the further you move away from the big coastal cities.
Dr. Michael Clements is a GP from Townsville and chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners Rural Faculty.
We know that many of the towns that have poor or no access to GPs have higher rates of mental health distress that's not being treated. They have more chronic disease that maybe hasn't been diagnosed and then gets left untreated. And all of these poorer health outcomes means that the average age goes down a little bit. People suffer longer. And sadly, we know that if the town loses a good health capacity, sometimes the town starts winding down as well, because we know many families, when they're considering moving out to a rural area for work, whether that be in mining or industry or farming, if there's no good health care for their kids or for their parents or for themselves, they might not go out at all. So we do see that health plays a key enabling role for the growth of these rural towns as well. So all of those things are at risk.
In the lead up to the election, the RACGP has issued a wish list of policies it would like to see the next federal government implement. High on the agenda is longer patient consultation times, larger Medicare rebates, and more incentives to encourage workers to rural areas.
Well, listen, we're tired, to be frank. The rural workforce, the doctors, the GPs, the nurses, the receptionists, the physios, the nurse practitioners, the pharmacists have really been doing it tough over the last couple of years. They've had less support from locums sort of moving interstate to help. They've had less doctors and medical staff coming in from overseas to support workforce. And they've had a lot more asked of them in the last 2 years, not just with COVID and lockdowns, but actually the vaccination programs, the managing COVID in the community. Our Prime Minister said famously on TV, call your GP if you get COVID at the beginning of this year. And all of a sudden, you know, GPs across the country, that's if you had a GP, across the country got swamped. So we're tired, we're short-staffed, and sadly, we haven't seen anything dramatic in the election cycle that's going to reverse those things quickly. But pleasingly, there's been some recent announcements that might start to work towards the outcomes that we need.
What is it, do you think, that the next Australian government should be doing to make things better, not only for the healthcare workers in regional and rural areas, but for the people that live in those areas?
Yeah, well, I guess being an election cycle, we often talk about money. So, you know, we do need new money. You know, Medicare funding or the proportion of overall government funding going to primary healthcare, like in the community with GPs, has been decreasing when you compare it to the state hospital funding and hospitals year on year. So we need to see that reverse. We actually need to see real and new investment going into solving some of these troubles.
If re-elected, the Coalition says it will invest more than $1 billion into rural healthcare, which would see more than 6,000 doctors and nurses working in regional and rural communities over the next decade. The Coalition has also pledged more funding for frontline mental health services and suicide prevention, including more than $45 million in federal funding for mental health in Tasmania. It's the only state or territory to receive targeted mental health funding. Anthony Albanese has pledged a Labor government would cut the cost of medication, better support people living with a disability, and make it easier to see a doctor. When it comes to mental health, Labor has also campaigned on a policy to reinstate funding for telehealth psychiatry sessions, allowing regional and rural Australians to access bulk billed services. The Greens have meanwhile outlined a targeted mental health policy, which would invest nearly $5 billion to ensure mental health is fully covered under Medicare. Last week, Professor Ian Hickey AM from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre told ABC Radio none of the mental health policies put forward by the major parties hit the mark.
Neither party is offering the key focus yet required. What the Labor Party has picked up, which the Coalition has not really emphasised yet, is the importance of this in regional and rural Australia. The Productivity Commission said very directly, we've got to make it work in the 50 regions of Australia, particularly those that don't have the specialist services, those outside of the major cities. those who are always left out. And to do that, we need to do it differently. So both parties need to lift their game. I found much more interest from the independents and from those who really represent regional and rural Australia than from the major parties.
And what about policies relating to Indigenous health? Both ALP and the Greens have pledged to strengthen First Nations health through community-led First Nations health services. Labor has said it will spend $52 million to train First Nations people for healthcare jobs. And the Greens say they will provide $1.7 billion to build First Nation-owned healing places. Dan Carter is the Executive Director of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health within the Central West Hospital and Health Service. He's travelled across the region to help develop a strategy to improve access to healthcare in First Nations communities.
We're still seeing in remote areas that, you know, we're getting rheumatic heart disease, a disease that's effectively eradicated in Australia, but it still exists in Aboriginal communities. And that really comes down to access to healthcare and equitable access to healthcare. So understanding the barriers that First Nations people experience is really part of, you know, especially for our health services, it's really part of what we need to consider when we're delivering a health service, that we from the outset are acknowledging the barriers that exist and are coming in with a service that can address that. We want to make sure that we are employing First Nations people, that First Nations people are seeing First Nations people when they come into health services, that our service is essentially representative of the community it serves.
Back in Longreach, Casey Owen thinks leaders in the city are out of touch with the needs of regional voters. She'd like to see the next federal government prioritise healthcare in communities like hers.
It's hard, I guess. You know, you read these sort of things and see that they're going to put all this funding together, but you sort of think how much of it is going to us, how much of it is going to the big smoke. So we'll see.
Business owner Casey Owen, and she was speaking there to our reporter Madeline McCusker in Longreach.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Working out who you're going to vote for tomorrow can be bewildering. But for people living with Alzheimer's and dementia and for their families, the whole issue can become a whole lot more complicated. So how do people living with dementia and their families grapple with this? And what are the rules? Victor Petrovich compiled this story for us.
For Darrell Radcliffe's father, giving up his driver's licence while living on the outskirts of West Wyalong because of his cognitive abilities was a tough thing to take.
Because we don't live there and none of his daughters lived in town, it was probably the community reaching out to us, concerned about him not giving way and having nearnesses, that we had to make that decision. And it wasn't an easy decision to make. It wasn't good because he wasn't happy about it, but for his safety and for others' safety, we had to make that decision.
And for families like Ms. Radcliffe's, another complicated decision can be whether their family member living with dementia is going to vote at an election. She says in her father's case, he may have been able to vote depending on the day, as his long-term memory of things like who he may want to vote for was often better than his short-term memory.
It's probably depended on the day. My father knew us right to the end. It was day-to-day things that he would forget. But he could have, you know, made the decision to vote, I guess. And look, it is everyone's legal right to vote. So I guess it just depends on the dementia sufferer and have they got an ability to make a decision. And if they have, well, I'm sure they should be able to vote.
There are no laws stopping those aged over 18 with dementia from voting. And honorary medical advisor to Dementia Australia, Associate Professor Michael Woodward, says there is no reason to think people with the condition shouldn't vote.
I think the most important point is not to assume that because a person has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or given a clinical diagnosis of dementia, they automatically can't vote. That's not the law, nor do I think it respects their dignity and their autonomy. I mean, if your grandpa has always voted one particular way, it's very likely he'd want to vote the same way at this next election. And unless he says, I don't want to do it, I think I'd give him the opportunity to vote.
For the nearly 500,000 Australians living with dementia and their families, there is a balance to be struck based on each individual's circumstances. While voting can be complex for many families, Associate Professor Michael Woodward from Dementia Australia says there are ways for them to have these discussions.
A reasonable first question was, there's an election coming up, you know, those elections that we have every few years, and how do you feel about voting? And they might say, well, you know, I don't really want to do it. Well, you respect that decision. Or they might show that they don't really have much understanding and that they don't have any desire to vote. So that's okay too. But I think you should have the conversation. You shouldn't just assume that because a person has been given a diagnosis of dementia or a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, they should not even be offered the chance to vote.
And he says there is no reason to assume people with dementia have less of a grasp on what they're voting for than anyone else.
If they show no desire to not vote, in other words, there's no reason for them not voting, even without understanding policies, I think it's quite reasonable to give them the opportunity to vote. I don't think we require a person to understand the political platform to be able to vote. And in fact, it'd be fair to say that I think a lot of people don't have a full understanding of the policies and the promises of the parties that they're voting for, but they still vote.
Associate Professor Michael Woodward ending that story from Viktor Petrovich and Simon Wallace. And the Electoral Commission says that people can assist someone to vote, but you can't do it for them. And that assistance is always at the request of the voter themselves.
ABC Australia Wide.
You're with me, Sinead Mangan. Production of the latest Mad Max film has begun and it's creating quite a buzz in southern New South Wales. The Riverina town of Hay has welcomed hundreds of film crew members, which is providing an economic boost just when it's needed. Rami Stevens has filed this story for us today.
The last film in the Mad Max series, Fury Road, was meant to be filmed in the far west of New South Wales. Back in 2011, rain in the region meant the Broken Hill landscape was too green, so production had to move to Namibia in southern Africa. But film crews are back in Australia with a new film, Furiosa, this time shooting on the outskirts of Hay. Hotel manager Emil Rebellia says his hotel isn't the only one fully booked.
Most people are very happy about it. I think it's really, really good for business, especially after COVID. And it's a lot of business have been struggling.
But he says the influx of people into town has put pressure on the local workforce.
We can't get enough staff here, for example. So we have signs up downstairs. We've got signs in the supermarket on the notice board, up on Facebook, on backpacker groups and trying to get people, which is pretty much what we have to do.
Businesses are catering for hundreds of production staff. Cafe manager Megan Griffith says her cafe made more than 200 coffees in a single day.
Mornings have got a lot busier than normal. I suppose they tend to head out a bit earlier than what we would normally start getting busy.
And weekends?
Flat chat. Flat chat. Weekends is really busy.
Hey, Mayor Carol Otaway says there's been a huge flow-on effect to a range of local businesses.
Our accommodation providers, they're all fully booked. I think there's a 100% occupancy rate at the moment. You'll see their neon no vacancy signs in the window, so you know that things are good when you see those. I know all the local food outlets are experiencing more people coming in requiring to be fed. So there's, lots of waiting time now. We wait a little bit longer for our meals than what we used to.
She says the agricultural town of around 2,500 people is recovering from more than just COVID-19.
We've just come out of a very long drought and confidence was really at an all-time low. We had businesses shutting their doors in the main street. We had a declining population. School enrolments were declining. Local primary school, for example, had halved its enrolment numbers, 360 to 180, within the space of about 6 or 7 years. So it just was a very dark time for Hay.
It's not every day Tinseltown comes to regional Australia, but here in Hay, locals are lapping up the chance to host the production of what's expected to be a Hollywood blockbuster.
The town feels alive again. Unfortunately, with COVID, it was very quiet, and I think people were sort of nervous to get out and about, but I feel like there's a real buzz about town again.
They've been buying clothes and things around town, so I think it's bringing a lot of good to Hay, and just having the numbers here too is bringing the money back to the little towns.
The Mad Max films have a long association with Australia, launching actor Mel Gibson's career. After Hay, production of the latest instalment heads to Silverton near Broken Hill. But for the time being, locals like Mr. Rebellia are enjoying their 15 minutes of fame.
Would you like and hate Hollywood?
Maybe Haywood.
Rummy Stevens reporting. And that's a wrap for Australia Wide this week. For all your election coverage tomorrow, make sure you tune into the ABC. The Australia Votes election night coverage begins on ABC from 6 o'clock tomorrow night. I know what I'll be watching. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.